So I'm Steven Bloom. I'm a PhD student at the University of Leuven, and I'm working on evolutionary models for the seismic study of solar B stars. But it's work that is carried out together with Haile and Marc-Antoine, who delivered the theoretical tools for me to do that. And then Roy and Connie, who are my supervisors in Leuven. And I must, of course, also say that I'm working in Connie's prosperity project, because otherwise I won't get paid at the end of the month. I think my first slide is already, well, been told by the previous speakers. So why are we doing a seismology of SDBs? One reason is, of course, to gain insight in the internal structure and diffusion processes. But another one, and very important one, is the one that was dealt by Valerie, is the fact that if you can do accurate determinations of certainly the mass and also the envelope masses and the radii of these stars, they can compare these with the proposed formation channels and allow the guys that are working on these formation channels to tune them. So what is different between our approach and then the approach followed by Stéphane and his group is that we try to use evolutionary models of SDBs and not static models. That has advantages and disadvantages, as Stéphane clearly outlined already. So we're using evolutionary tracks that are computed by the Eggleton code with a lot of updates to include diffusion processes mainly, and then use the non-adiabatic pulsation codes written by Marc-Antoine to compute the pulsation properties. So the initial grid that we computed contained about 1,000 evolutionary tracks with all different starting total masses and envelope masses to end up with about 200,000 models. And we choose one mislicity for it because indeed we have no clue on what the mislicity of SDBs is. And in these models, in this initial grid, we used artificial iron enhancements in the envelope to drive the pulsations. That is mostly done up to now because these diffusion processes is really a recent thing that we've been working on that. And then we try to minimize kind of merit function, as Stéphane and Valerie already showed you. And I started testing that last year with a P-mode pulsator that has been modeled already by other groups. And if I match all my models, find the best match between the observed and theoretical frequencies in all my models, then the chi squares that I end up with in function of the effective temperature of the models is shown here. And the best model would have to effective about 20,000, 21,000. And though we know from spectroscopy that that's completely impossible and it should be more like 34,000. So it's a bit of a shame that as seismology wouldn't be able to tell apart a star with a T effective of 20,000 and one of 34,000. So what I try to do next is use the fact that we are doing non-adiabatic pulsation calculations and use the constraint that it offers on the possible excitation of the modes. And if you do that, the best models nicely end up in the spectroscopic effective temperature region. If you look at the same plot, but in log G, it's basically the same situation. You would be way off without the non-adiabatic information, and with the adiabatic information, you get into the right region. If you then look at the masses of all these models, because that's finally what we're after, you see that on any track, you can basically match a model more or less if you do not use the theoretical mode instability. If you do, then you start to converge to a certain total and envelope mass. But that's for the P-mode pulsators. I try to do the same thing for the G-mode pulsators because they have more diagnostics. And Kepler and Crowe have been delivering us these very beautiful data last couple of years. And unfortunately, it doesn't really work. Well, you find models all over the place if you don't use non-adiabatic information, and if you do, then you don't even find anything that's close to the spectroscopic box. If I show you the same plots in log G, I don't have to explain anything here. It's exactly the same situation. So we definitely need extra constraints to tell apart different models. One thing you can do is fix the effective temperature in log G, so set a constraint on the use a spectroscopic box, basically, to fit your models and to discriminate between them. Another thing you can do is modernification. People have tried using spectroscopy for it. It turned out to be very hard and almost useless if you want to determine really the modes of a whole set in one star. Another way to do it maybe is using optational multiplets, because from the splitting you can often tell what kind of mode it is. And Kepler is enabling us now to do this kind of things, and Steve Kowaler has a PhD student working on that at the moment, and the first results seem to be very nice. So I hope that that will help us out in the end. And another way to do it is your ratios of amplitudes in different passbands. But that we cannot do with Kepler because it's only it's only one color. And then a last one, which doesn't show up. Okay, is maybe to use asymptotic period spacing relations. And that comes back to the what Tim said earlier. You might have an extra diagnostic if you use the period spacings, and look in your models to see what period spacings they have. And Mike Reed published a paper this year which has caused a lot of controversy in the community, certainly at the meeting in South Africa, where he claims that he can match 70% of the modes in the Kepler G-mode pulsators with L equals 1 and L equals 2 series. Now, I'll give you the most beautiful examples. The others are less nice and less convincing. So for example, in this observed observed Fourier transform of observed data, he finds a whole lot of peaks that are spaced by a certain spacing, and the same for a second set that might be L equals 2. Now, of course, if you want to do this just by using equidistant period spacings, then you assume that there is no mode trapping, which is probably not true. So there might be peaks that are trapped away from the linear relation and are as such not picked up as L equals 1 and L equals 2 modes. And the other way, modes can get trapped into the other series. So we have to be careful by just using all the identifications for individual modes. But I guess that indeed there is some extra diagnostic from using the average period spacing, which I think is probably not far off in the stars where you can identify lots of modes. This is a second example. Another way to fix it, of course, is to try to get your theoretical mode instability right, because it seems to work for P modes, it doesn't for G modes. And therefore, we started to compute another grid of models, including radiative levitation this time. And then we don't need this artificial iron enhancements anymore, because now the levitation deals with it for us and computes how large these enhancements should be. So we did that, and it is computationally intensive, but it turns out to pay off. This is the enhancements for iron on the left, so normalized by initial enhancement, and for nickel on the right, for models with different total masses on these tracks, and then for different envelope masses. And what you see is that the iron and nickel abundances that get built up are a factor 10 for iron, more than the initial abundance, up to a factor 40. Why? In our initial grid, we had assumed that it was 10 for all of them. And for nickel, it's even worse. We had assumed 10 for nickel as well, but it goes up to 3,000. So getting this much extra iron and nickel in your driving region makes it possible to drive G modes way better than what we could do in our first grid. If you look at the P modes, then you see that models with instable modes, so these are the modes with the models that have more than 1/5 of the modes that can be excited. This is more than 5%. So this instability region is more or less the same now in the grids with radiative levitation. But if you go to the G modes, then you see that you can go to much higher temperatures, and that's also needed to explain the observed instability strip. We haven't been able to compute a full grid yet as dense as the one I have here, because it takes so much time. But I'm hopeful that if we manage to do it, and that this might help us so that we can use this constraint from the non-adiabatic information to discriminate between models that fit well and don't fit. And then to come back on another way to discriminate between models, that's to do multicolor photometry and have amplitude ratios. We're building a dedicated camera for that at the moment. We have the Mercator telescope, Long Beach telescope on La Palma, available for us for about 70% of the nights. So this camera will be able to observe in three bands simultaneous, has full frame frame transfer CCDs. And it should have been ready for the beginning of my PhD, so about a year and a half ago. If the engineer's clock would have been as good as the one of our chairs, it would have been there already, but the latest estimate I got was May, Connie. So it's getting worse. Like, I get extra months every day ask for it. But still, I hope that I manage to finish it before the end of my PhD so that I can actually use it. So to summarize things, we try to use astroseismology to constrain the SDV formation channels using evolutionary grids, now including radiative levitation so that we can get a good handle on the iron and nickel abundances in the driving region. And we hope that further degeneracy can also be broken by multicolor photometry to identify modes and, who knows, period spacings. But it's all work in progress, and that's, of course, why we're here at this program.
Okay, Stephen, I'm a bit worried with the idea of using the modern stability, mm-hmm. or the driving, as a constraint to the fit, because it depends so much on the amount of heavy metals that you get in a deep earth region, and it depends so much on the opacity that might be dangerous to really make that a strict constraint. We have looked at that mm-hmm. in the past, but it was always after finding fits we were checking if it was okay, especially for the PMOD pulsators. With the expectation from the non-adiabatic calculations, usually it was okay, but using that as a strict constraint is it might be. I mean, there are a lot of uncertainties still behind that. Even though you can more or less adjust the instability strips.
Well, maybe we shouldn't use it as a too strict constraint. But on the other hand, I don't feel comfortable with matching modes that are almost. They have no chance to get excited.
Sure. And if you're sure that they have no chance
to get excited. Well, but the degeneracy is such that I think we need something extra. At least that's what I get out of matching with all the models. In it.
It's so much fun to have a debate.
Hi. Stephen, can you just, about these period spacings in the Kepler stars that were reported by Reed et al., I mean, from an observational point of view, there seem to be clear periodicities. Mm-hmm. And they have about the right period spacing for what we would expect. So I'm just trying to understand what the controversy is. Are you saying that the period spacings themselves are real but are caused
by
something else?
No, well, the controversy is more in the fact that Mike said that this proves that there is almost no mode trapping in SDVs. Well, that is probably not true, because if a mode gets trapped far enough, then it's not picked up as in a series anymore. So the fact that he can explain many modes just by two series, L equals one, L equals two, doesn't mean that there is no mode trapping.
So when you say mode trapping, it's what we call acoustic glitches, wiggles in the period spacing.
Yes.
Okay, I understand. That. Thank you.
So we're talking about G modes.
Pardon?
Yeah, it's G modes, of course.
Sure, sure. Yeah. But it's the same idea, right? Yeah.
No. Well. So I'm confused.
Yeah, me too, but.
Well, you have to pass a PhD, so that's worse. I'm confused by the fact that Stefan and also Valerie and so on in their papers have shown very, very good fits to the Corona and Kepler data, very tightly constrained parameters with a very. I don't know what the reduced chi-squared was, but it looks small at least. I mean, it might not be one, but it's certainly small. Whereas you find a very broad fit and a fairly poor fit, actually, that doesn't really constrain the parameters very tightly. So there's some inconsistency between, of course, these are different models, but we should really understand why the two methods give such very different results.
I completely understand your confusion, because that's exactly my confusion. But if I don't use these non-adiabatic properties, then I get chi-squares that are as low or lower than the published models. But I find them in a very broad region.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
Yes. And sure. I don't know why I find these in a very broad region.
Well, Stefan is really better fitting than you are.
It turns out to be very constrained.
No, it's, of course, this is really the point of the program to really try to sort out that and do it before you leave.
Yeah. <You will.
laughs> You did a schematic, but simply because you didn't have enough computer time. You did a sketch of the phase space that you had available. Mm-hmm. Could you use that along with your artificial technique to fill it in and do as an immediate step?
That's what we plan to do, to use this and interpolate in between the different masses and envelope masses that we have now, and use the determined iron and nickel abundance enhancements
to pin it down with the ones you're
to then go
to
back to
okay,
the,
very good.
Yeah, parameterized one, which computes way faster.
Yeah, I just want to note another difference between the static models and the evolutionary models, and that's the effect that the helium and hydrogen diffusion has a big impact on the periods as well, and this is not incorporated in the static models, so that's something that also might affect the past seismic models.
Just a question of curiosity, the several order of magnitude increase in the nickel abundance that we created with radiative levitation, does it match with observed abundances from spectroscopy in this class of stars?
Well, no, because it's certainly not in contradiction with it. But the fact is that it's very hard to go from an observed spectrum to the enhancement in the layer where you need it for the driving of the boats. Because a very tiny wind, for example, can change the observed abundances by huge factors. And the fact that nickel is so much more enhanced is mostly due to the fact that it starts off far lower than the iron abundance. So in the end, the abundances of nickel and iron get about the same in number fractions. But nickel starts off so much lower that you need a factor 5,000 or 3,000 to get to the same level.
So you have a saturation of the limitation somehow.
Yes, after like 10 to the 7th year, it saturates and it doesn't really change anymore during the evolution.
You're saying nickel enhancement?
Are you aware about it, Stefan or Steve, of the nickel enhancements that are observed on the surface? It's But you build it up in the driving region and less in the envelope.
Sorry, I
lunchtime.
Let's say for the speakers.